Our scripture reading this morning is Hosea 8. Hosea chapter 8, verse 1 to 14. It's on page 958 in the Pew Bible. Set the trumpet to your lips. One like a vulture is over the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. To me they cry, "My God, we, Israel, know you." Israel has spurned the good. The enemy shall pursue him. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but I knew it not. With their silver and gold they make idols for their own destruction. I have spurned your call, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For it is from Israel. A craftsman made it. It is not God. The calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads. It shall yield no flour. If it were to yield, strangers would devour it. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel. For they have gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. Though they hire allies among the nations, I will soon gather them up. And the king and princes shall soon rise because of the tribute. Because Ephraim has multiplied altars for sinning, they have become to him altars for sinning. Were I to write for him my laws by the 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. As for my sacrificial offerings, they sacrifice meat and eat it, but the Lord does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt. For Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces, and Judah has multiplied fortified cities. So I will send a fire upon his cities, and it shall devour her strongholds. May God bless his word to our hearts.
Sid Meier's Civilization game that you play on the computer and all its different versions has you start out with a simple settler and maybe one military unit or a worker. And from those two units in the Stone Age, in order to win the game, you must develop a world-class civilization, a space-age technologically advanced civilization with millions of citizens. The goal of the game? Defeat, win, be the best civilization by beating out the other civilizations that are developing alongside you. And one of the ways in which you win in this game, there are multiple ways, but one way is to be the military conqueror. Wipe out the other civilizations. And so you can go to war with them as you get your knowledge and your technology and your resources. And as you go to war with them, you can either capture their cities and make it part of your civilization, or you can just simply annihilate their cities. One of the interesting strategies, though, is for this game, as you're trying to go to war with another civilization, is not to simply go to war and continuously remain at war with the civilization until you wipe it out. Rather, the better strategy is, every so often, say, "Hey, Egypt, I'll give you a cessation of hostilities." Or, "China, I'll give you a peace treaty in exchange for gold, for your gold, or for some of your technological advances that I don't have." You see, if you simply go to war and wipe out the nation, you can't get their gold and you can't get their technology. So you have to offer these intermittent peace treaties or cessation of hostilities. And basically you're saying to them, I won't wipe you out if you give me your gold or you give me your knowledge. And then once you've milked them of all their gold, then you can wipe them out later in the game and win. Now, look at what Hosea, how Israel in the 8th century BC is described as in chapter 8, verses 8 and 9. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel, for they have gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. And here Israel is being compared to a useless pot or a vessel or a container that has nothing in it. It's been emptied out. Like an empty pop can or a strawberry container that we use today. You use it once, it's empty, it's useless, you toss it. From Hosea chapter 7, verses 8 to 11, we saw the attempts of ancient Israel doing their wheeling and dealing with all different types of nations. They'd made alliances to try to survive. The thing that we saw, though, is those alliances cost them money. It cost them economically. It cost them culturally. And so, actually, they were being bled to death. In order for some help, or what they thought was help, they gave their gold. They gave up some of their culture so that they may possibly survive longer. But it only drained the nation and made it weaker. And so as Israel flip-flopped in alliances between Syria, Egypt, and Assyria, and their resources were exhausted, the other nations had no more reason to protect Israel, no more reason to stay in an alliance with them. You see, as in the game Civilizations, once you've milked the nation of all its gold, there's no reason to stay, to let it live. You enter its land, you take it for yourself. And this, in a sense, is kind of what's happening on the international scene with ancient Israel. The larger nations have milked it. Now they're just going to take it. Therefore, chapter 8, verse 1 starts off with this alarm. Blow the trumpet, sound the alarm. There's a marauding army that is just close by, symbolized by this bird of prey. Even though you have built strongholds and fortified cities, verse 14 says, it's not going to protect you. This army is going to overwhelm you. You will be devoured. From the internal clues of the chapter, we see that this is getting very late in the timing of the nation's history. They must be close to their last decade. They've already made their alliances, verse 9. They've already set up multiple kings that God has not approved, verse 4. Verse 10, it says, soon or now, God's going to gather them up. And this comes after chapter 7 with all that political dealing, wheeling and dealing that has failed. So Israel's history, the timing for Israel to die is getting close. Now we're actually now, as we start chapter 8, we're halfway through Hosea. And you know the general reason that is stated in verse 1 as to why Israel is going to die. They broke the covenant that they made with God. God, you will be our God. We will worship you exclusively. We will be your people. And we will follow your laws. Well, they forgot all that, they broke all that, they rejected all that. But chapter 8 focuses on two primary ways in which they have broken the covenant. The first is what we saw largely from chapter 7. They chose their own kings and made international alliances. When Moses gave the law to the Israelites when they entered covenant with God at Mount Sinai, there was a section on kings. You'll find it in Deuteronomy 17. And Deuteronomy 17, chapter 17, verse 5, states very specifically this: you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. So the selection of a king for Israel always depended on God. And he would make that selection known through the prophet, and the priests would endorse it. And so Hosea pronounces here in verse 4, they have made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but I knew it not. In other words, God's saying, in the last 30 years of your existence, you've set up kings that you chose, but I did not choose, that I did not choose. And so Hosea makes that known. And indeed, we saw that in the last 30 years of Israel's existence in the 8th century, they had 6 kings, 4 of whom they assassinated. And they were all their own choice. And because they could not hang on to power, because they were weak kings, they made these alliances with international powers. And all that did was speed up the death of the nation. And that was all explained, and we looked at that a couple weeks ago in chapter 7. So I'll move on to the second primary way that chapter 8 focuses on in terms of their breaking the covenant, and that is they made their own gods and their own idols. How many of you at some point in your life made the decision to attempt to read through the Bible beginning to end, starting in Genesis? Yeah, most of us, right? Particularly when we are new Christians and we become a Christian. Yeah, let's read the whole Bible. Let's hear the whole Word of God and read straight through it. And how many of you got stuck in Leviticus? Deuteronomy. You know, it starts off in Genesis, creation of the world, and Abraham and Joseph, and it's exciting. You get in the first half of Exodus, the second book of the Bible, and there's Moses and the burning bush and the release of the Egyptians from slavery and the 10 plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea. And then halfway through Exodus, all of a sudden you get all these laws and regulations. Okay, this is how you're to make all the furnishings in the tabernacle, and make sure you use this kind of hair for the curtains, and make sure it's dyed this color, and this is how many cubits this instrument is to be, and this is how you make the garments for the high priests, and then get into Leviticus, and you get all the different offerings. Okay, you have the burnt offering, the grain offering, the fellowship offering, the sin offering, and oh, for this one you have to use a bull, and this one you have to use a lamb, and, oh, you may use a goat. Oh, and if it's this sin, you need to, and you know, and then it gets into the other laws about mildew and molds and bodily fluids and Sabbaths and what you can eat and cannot eat. And it goes on through Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and most of us, when we made that decision, let's read straight through the Bible, we stop there and we start skipping some books. It's interesting what it says here about ancient Israel in verse 12. Were I to write for him my laws, by the 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. What? All these detailed laws that take up several books of the Bible, they're regarded as strange, as foreign, as unknown to Israel? How could his chosen people be unfamiliar with all these laws? There's so many of them that we can't even make it through them. Well, Hosea chapter 4 revealed to us why Israel did not know the law, even though they would, you know, as God said, he would write them by the 10,000s. Okay, so we photocopy them by the 10,000 and give them all out to the people in 8th century Israel, and they'll look at that and go, well, that's new. Never seen that before. Well, it's because 200 years earlier, the priests and king decided that God's law was not going to be the authority for their life. We're not listening to this. We're not following this. And despite the fact that God had said very clearly, you shall not make any images, despite the fact God says you shall not have any other gods, under Jeroboam the first, 200 years earlier, prior to Hosea, they set up two golden calves, one in Bethel and one in Dan. And this unlawful priesthood continued to teach the people wrongly for 200 years, so that by the time you get to Hosea, 200 years later, though God had given his laws in great detail, people don't know it. It's strange to them. So they go on to just blatantly worship whatever they think is God. And therefore their claim in verse 2 that they know God is blatantly false. And when they go to offer their offerings, they're not forgiven. Their guilt is not taken away. But their places of worship become places of sin and condemnation, increasing their guilt. So Israel has broken covenant with God. They have, which includes a personal rejection of God. They have rejected God for their own kings. We don't need God to rule us. We don't need God to guide us. We don't need God to protect us. We can look after ourselves, thank you very much. We can make alliances with the other nations. We can set up our own kings. And by the way, God, we don't really think you're the only God that's there. We're going to just simply reject that, and we're going to worship other gods. We're going to make them with our own hands. We're going to give value to other things and deity to other things. Yet, that's rather curious, this chapter. Because despite the fact they have blatantly rejected God's word, despite the fact that they are openly worshiping the Baals, the Canaanite gods, we still find in this chapter, they still consider themselves the people of Yahweh, to use the Old Testament Hebrew name of God. Oh, Yahweh, we know you, we're your people. Verse 2. And then in verse 13, it indicates they're still sacrificing to Yahweh. And God himself said in chapter 7, verse 14, that God acknowledges they're still crying out to him, though it is very superficial. What's going on here? I mean, it's like they're other gods and then Yahweh, and it's like they're mixing stuff together. Well, that's exactly what they're doing. We call it syncretism. Syncretism is where the beliefs and values of other cultural and religious worldviews are mixed with the truth of the biblical or the Christian worldview. And it dilutes and changes the biblical and Christian worldview. Israel is a prime example. So you have verses 5 through 6. It talks about them making a calf. God says he spurns his calf. His anger burns against their idols. This calf may be the original one that Jeroboam the first had made 200 years earlier, and that was at Bethel. They still worshipped it. They still were concerned about it. Hosea chapter 10, verse 5 refers to that calf. Yet Yahweh had clearly told the Israelites, I am never, ever to be represented by any physical image of anything on the earth, in the heavens, or under the earth. Nothing can represent me physically. So don't make it. But in the ancient Near East, the bull was a very powerful symbol, a cultural symbol that presented great strength. The bull or the wild oxen was seen as a powerful animal. Even today in English, we have the phrase strong as a bull. And the bull was also seen as an animal of fertility. The bull was what you needed for your herds to grow. And so in the ancient Near East, and it was seen culturally as a symbol of strength and fertility. And it was then applied to their gods, to their deities. Well, our gods are strong as a wild ox. They're able to give fertility like a bull. And so they the Canaanite religions, even the Egyptian religion, some of the Mesopotamian religions, they made their gods in the shape of a bull or a wild ox, and they bowed to it. And the Israelites were all too ready to adopt that symbol of the bull from the larger culture and the Canaanite religions and apply it in their worship to Yahweh. Our God's strong. Let's make a bull. Despite God had clearly, directly prohibited the making of any image. Now, the strength and the popularity in the ancient Near Eastern culture of representing deities by images is seen in Exodus chapter 32. Just after Israel had come out of the promise, out of Egypt, they're at Mount Sinai. God has given Israel the preliminaries of the covenant, and they entered into agreement, and they know they're not to have any other gods or make any images. Moses goes back up on the mountain, spends 40 days or whatever it is there again. He's taking his time. He's not coming down. So the people get restless, and they say to Moses' brother Aaron, we don't know what's happened for this fellow Moses. Why don't you make us some gods? Aaron says, give me all your gold earrings. And he makes a calf, and the people embrace it wholeheartedly. These are the gods. This is the God that brought you up out of Egypt. Exodus 32 tells us how badly that ended. But once again, a few centuries later, Israel is mixing in cultural and pagan ideas, corrupting their worship, becoming idolaters. As in Exodus, now in Hosea, it will end badly. The calf idol will be destroyed, as will the nation. Duane Garrett notes that the Hebrew text of chapter 8, verses 4 through 6, has a number of uneven lines, broken grammar, rather than these smooth lines of poetry like the rest of it. And he suggests that that irregular language pattern is revealing a vexation and an anger of God over Israel's idolatry and syncretism, mixing the worship of other faiths to Yahweh. It's like God's so mad he can hardly speak. That's kind of what the language is hinting at. And so you and I might be sitting here today and we're thinking, Israelites, they're pretty stupid. I mean, didn't they learn the first time when they made a golden calf and how badly that turned out? That they shouldn't make another one? In fact, they made two. I mean, how dumb are they? I mean, what part of you shall have no other gods before me and do not make any images, don't you understand, Israel? Like, duh, it's pretty clear. But before we think like that, we need to take a good look at ourselves, the church today. Because syncretism is alive and well in the church today. And it results in our own idolatry. On September 23rd, 2001, there was an interfaith prayer service in the Yankee Stadium in New York. This was in response to the 9/11, the attacks on 9/11 on the World Trade Centers. And at this prayer service, there were Jewish rabbis, Sikh gurus, Catholic priests, Islamic imams, Protestant clergy, and they all prayed and they all sang to their respective gods and all read from their respective holy books. Interfaith worship may be defined as a fellowship of people from two or more different religious faiths joined together that may worship successively but separately or collectively and simultaneously, offering adoration, submission, and supplication to what each religious tradition holds to be the ultimate reality, or God. And the key thing to note there in that definition of what interfaith worship is about, what those meetings and prayer is about, is that they're there to worship. Worship what each one believes to be ultimately God. God. however they define that. Listen to what Robert Runcie, who was in the 1980s the Archbishop of Canterbury, the church in England. From the perspective of faith, different world religions can be seen as different gifts of the Spirit to humanity. Without losing our respective identities and the precious heritage and roots of our own faith, we can learn to see in a new way the message and insights of our faith in the light of that of others. By relating our respective visions of the divine to each other, we can discover a still greater splendor of divine life and grace. What's Robert Runcie saying? He's saying, first of all, two things. Number one, he's saying that other religions are gifts to humanity. Well, that's a flagrant contradiction of Romans chapter 1, which says other religions are the byproduct of human rebellion against God. Other religions are not gifts to humanity. Secondly, he is saying that Christians, as they participate in these interfaith worship gatherings, he's saying that the Christians are going to learn from the other faiths, other ideas of what God is from them, so that then we may grow in our own knowledge of God. Well, frankly, that's no different than the Israelites adopting ideas of the Canaanite gods and understanding God to be the same. That's no different than taking the methods of the Canaanites, making a calf idol, and saying, "This is our God. Let's worship him in the same way, with an image." Is not Runcie's claim a blatant rejection of "thou shalt not have any other gods before me"? Worship the Lord your God alone with all your heart, strength, soul, and mind? After 9/11, a study was done in 2005, random sampling of 884 churches in the United States. 22.3% participated in interfaith worship, and 37.5% joined interfaith community services in the previous 12 months. The pressure politically and culturally is going to only increase in our society in the form of deified patriotism and pseudo-tolerance that will increasingly demand we give to Caesar what is God's. Interfaith worship fuels this. The Christian church today, like ancient Israel, is in a life and death struggle. With syncretism and idolatry, interfaith worship is just but one form that is becoming more and more popular in our postmodern society. Then you have the syncretism of the American dream with Christianity, resulting in a false gospel. It's called the prosperity gospel or the wealth and health gospel. This gospel that is falsely proclaimed says that God always wants you healthy and wealthy and rich. They teach that there is a law of faith, that faith exists as an impersonal force, and you access it by basically an incantation, a spell. Repeat the faith formula of positive confession, and you will create your reality. So you want to be healthy, you want to be rich, you want to advance, say it, name it, claim it. It's yours. And if you dig into what they teach that God has to act according to this law of faith too. Otherwise, he cannot create. Well, if God cannot act on his own and he has to follow this force, this law of faith, then he isn't God. There's something greater than he is. And then we have, from our culture, syncretism of consumerism and the cultural value of entertainment. It corrupts our worship services. We're more concerned at times, did the people like the service and did they feel good? Wrong question. What's a worship service for? To entertain people? Absolutely not. Make people feel good? No. Worship service is where we gather together to collectively offer worship, adoration, a response to God for what he has done for us and said to us throughout the week. God is the focus, and we are giving to him. So the key question is, for every worship service, was God pleased with our worship? That's the one who we should be asking, who is pleased? That's the key question. But you see, our culture has so enveloped us that we come with a consumer mindset. What's in it for me? What am I going to get? And if I don't get something, I'm not going to be happy. We need to really change our mindset. So today, we must not smugly think that as the church in the 21st century, we are more pure or obedient than ancient Israel. We struggle with idolatry, we struggle with syncretism just as much as ancient Israel. The same spirit of idolatry that cause them to spiritually prostitute themselves works among us and tempts us today. But the question is, will we heed the call to repent? Ancient Israel did not and was destroyed. Israel's history was written down so that the church may not repeat the sins of ancient Israel, so that we may not be destroyed. I close with these verses that I presented to you when we first began the study of Hosea. Why should we study the Old Testament prophets? And one of the reasons is because we can learn from the mistakes and the temptations and the failures of ancient Israel so that we don't repeat it. The verses say this: Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolatrous as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up and to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction on whom the end of the ages has come. 1 Corinthians 10:6-10.